Stories for Men by John Kessel. 1. Erno couldn't get to the club until an hour after it opened, so, of course, the place was crowded, and he got stuck in the back behind three queens whose loud, aimless conversation made him edgy. He was never less than edgy anyway. Erno, a 17-year-old biotech apprentice, known for the clumsy, earnest intensity with which he propositioned almost every girl he met. It was more people than Erno had ever seen in the oxygen warehouse. Even though Tyler Durden had not yet taken the stage, every table was filled, and people stood three deep at the bar. Rosamund, the owner, bustled back and forth providing drinks, her face glistening with sweat. The crush of people only irritated Erno. He had been one of the first to catch on to Durden, and the room full of others, some of whom had probably come on his own recommendation, struck him as usurpers. Erno forced his way to the bar and bought a tincture. Tyrus and Sid, friends of his, nodded at him from across the room. Erno sipped the cool, licorice-flavored drink and eavesdropped, and gradually his thoughts took on an architectural, intricate intellectuality. A friend of his mother sat with a couple of sons who anticipated for her what she was going to see. "He's not just a comedian, he's a philosopher," said the skinny one. His foot, crossed over his knee, bounced in rhythm to the jazz playing in the background. Erno recognized him from a party he'd attended a few months back. "We have philosophers," the matron said. "We even have comedians." "Not like Tyler Durden," said the other boy. "Tyler Durden, who gave him that name?" "I think it's historical," the first boy said. "Not any history I ever heard," the woman said. "Who's his mother?" Erno noticed that there were more women in the room than there had been at any performance he had seen. Already the matrons were homing in. You could not escape their sisterly curiosity, their motherly tyranny. He realized that his shoulders were cramped. He rolled his head to try to loosen the spring-tight muscles. The oxygen warehouse was located in what had been a shop in the commercial district of the Northwest Lava Tube. It was a free enterprise zone, and no one had objected to the addition of a tinctures bar, though some eyebrows had been raised when it was discovered that one of the tinctures sold was alcohol. The stage was merely a raised platform in one corner. Around the room were small tables with chairs. The bar spanned one end, and the other featured a false window that showed a nighttime cityscape of old New York. Rosamund Demi's daughter, who'd started the club, at first booked local jazz musicians. Her idea was to present as close to a retro-Earth atmosphere as could be managed on the far side of the moon, where few of the inhabitants had ever even seen the Earth. Her clientele consisted of a few immigrants and a larger group of rebellious young cousins who were looking for an avant-garde. Erno knew his mother would not approve his going to the warehouse, so he was there immediately. He pulled his pack of fireless cigarettes from the inside pocket of his black 20th century suit, shook out a fag, inhaled it into life, and imagined himself living back on Earth 100 years ago. Exhaling a plume of cool, rancid smoke, he caught a glimpse of his razor haircut in the mirror behind the bar, then adjusted the knot of his narrow tie. After some minutes, the door beside the bar opened, and Tyler Durden came out. He leaned over and exchanged a few words with Rosamund. Some of the men whistled and cheered. Rosamund flipped a brandy snifter high into the air, where it caught the ceiling lights as it spun in the low G, then slowly fell back to her hand. Having attracted the attention of the audience, she hopped over the bar and onto the small stage. "Don't you people have anything better to do?" she shouted. A chorus of rude remarks. "Welcome to the oxygen warehouse," she said. "I want to say, before I bring him out, that I take no responsibility for the opinions expressed by Tyler Durden. He is not my boy." Durden stepped onto the stage. The audience was quiet, a little nervous. He ran his hand over his shaved head, gave a boyish grin. He was a big man in his 30s, wearing the blue coveralls of an environmental technician. Around his waist, he wore a belt with tools hanging from it, as if he'd just come off shift.
"Make love, not war," Durden said. "Remember that one? You got that from your mother in the school. I never liked that one. Make love, not war, they'll tell you. I hate that. I want to make love and war. I don't want my dick just to be a dick. I want it to stand for something."
A heckler from the audience shouted, "Can it stand on its own?" Durden grinned. "Let's ask it." He addressed his crotch. "Hey, son," he called down, "don't you like screwing?"
Durden looked up at the ceiling. His face went simple, and he became his dick talking back to him.
"Hiya, Dad," he squeaked. "Sure, I like screwing."
Durden winked at a couple of guys in makeup and lace in the front row, then looked down again.
"Boys or girls?"
His dick.
"What day of the week is it?"
"Thursday."
"Doesn't matter then. Thursday's guest mammal day."
"Outstanding, son.
I'm a good partner."
The queers laughed. Erno did too.
"You want I should show you?"
"Not now, son," Tyler told his dick.
"You keep quiet for a minute and let me explain to the people, okay?"
"Sure. I'm here whenever you need me."
"I'm aware of that."
Durden addressed the audience again. "Remember what Mama says, folks. Keep your son close, let your semen go." He recited the slogan with an exaggerated rhythm, wagging his finger at them, sober as a scolding grandmother. The audience loved it. Some of them chanted along with the catchphrase. Durden was warming up.
"But is screwing all there is to a dick?"
"I say no. A dick is a sign of power. It's a tower of strength. It's the tree of life. It's a weapon. It's an incisive tool of logic. It's the seeker of truth. Mama says that being male is nothing more than a performance. You know what I say to that?
Perform this, baby."
He grabbed his imaginary cock with both of his hands, made a stupid face. Cheers. "But of course they can't perform this. I don't care how you plank the genes, Mama don't have the machinery. Not only that, she don't have the programming, but Mama wants to program us with her half-baked scheme of what women want a man to be. This whole place is about fucking up our hardware with their software." He was laughing himself now. Beads of sweat stood out on his scalp in the bright light. "Mama says, don't confuse your penis with a phallus." He assumed a female sway of his hips, lifted his chin and narrowed his eyes. Just like that, he was an archetypal matron. His voice transmuted into a fruity contralto. "Yes, you boys do have those nice little dicks, but we're living in a post-phallic society. A penis is merely a biological appendage." Now he was her son, responding,
"Like a foot, Mom?"
"Mama." "Yes, son, exactly like a foot." Quick as a spark, back to his own voice. "How many of you in the audience here have named your foot?" Laughter, a show of hands. "Okay, so much for the foot theory of the penis. But Mama says the penis is designed solely for the propagation of the species. Sex gives pleasure in order to encourage procreation. A phallus, on the other hand. Whichever hand you like, I prefer the left." More laughter. "A phallus is an idea, a cultural creation of the dead patriarchy, a symbolic sheath applied over the penis to give it meanings that have nothing to do with biology." Durden seized his invisible dick again.
"Apply my symbolic sheath, baby. Oh, yes, I like it."
Erno had heard Tyler talk about his symbolic sheath before. Though there were variations, he watched the audience instead. Did they get it? Most of the men seemed to be engaged and laughing. A drunk in the first row leaned forward, hands on his knees, howling at Tyler's every word. Queers leaned their heads together and smirked. Faces gleamed in the close air, but a lot of the men's laughter was nervous, and some did not laugh at all. A few of the women, mostly the younger ones, were laughing. Some of them seemed mildly amused, puzzled. Some looked bored. Others sat stonily with expressions that could only indicate anger. Erno did not know how he felt about the women who were laughing. He felt hostility toward those who looked bored. "Why did you come here?" he wanted to ask them. "Who do you think you are?" He preferred those who looked angry. That was what he wanted from them. Then he noticed those who looked calm, interested, alert, yet unamused. These women scared him. In the back of the room stood some green-uniformed constables, male and female, carrying batons, red lights gleaming in the corner of their mirror specs, recording. Looking around the room, Erno located at least a half dozen of them. One, he saw with a start, was his mother. He ducked behind a tall man beside him. She might not have seen him yet, but she would see him sooner or later. For a moment, he considered confronting her, but then he sidled behind a row of watchers toward the back rooms. Another constable, her slender lunar physique distorted by the bulging muscles of a genetically engineered testosterone girl, stood beside the doorway. She did not look at Erno. She was watching Tyler, who was back to conversing with his dick.
"I'm tired of being confined,"
Tyler's dick was saying. "You feel constricted?" Tyler asked. He looked up in dumb appeal.
"I'm stuck in your pants all day."
Looking down, "I can let you out, but first tell me, are you a penis or a phallus?"
"That's a distinction without a difference."
"Au contraire, little man, you haven't been listening."
"I'm not noted for my listening ability."
"Sounds like you're a phallus to me," Tyler told his dick.
"We have lots of room for penises, but Mama don't allow no phalluses around here." "Let my people go."
"Nice try, but wrong color. Look, son, it's risky when you come out. You could get damaged. The phallic liberation movement is in its infancy."
"I thought you cousins were all about freedom."
"In theory. In practice, free phalluses are dangerous."
"Who says?"
"Well, Deborah does. And so does Mary and Sue and Jamina, most every time I see her. And there was this lecture in We Wine You Listen class last week, and Ramona says so too, and of course, most emphatically, Baba. And then there's that bitch Nora." Erno spotted his mother moving toward his side of the room. He slipped past the constable into the hall. There was the restroom and a couple of other doors. A gale of laughter washed in from the club behind him at the climax of Tyler's story. Cursing his mother, Erno went into the restroom. No one was there. He could still hear the laughter, but not the cause of it. His mother's presence had cut him out of the community of male watchers as neatly as if she had used a baton. Erno felt murderously angry. He switched on a urinal and took a piss. Over the urinal, a window played a scene in Central Park, on Earth, of 100 years ago. A night scene of a pathway beneath some trees, trees as large as the largest in Sobieski Park. A line of electric lights on poles threw pools of light along the path, and through the pools of light strolled a man and a woman. They were talking, but Erno could not hear what they were saying. The woman wore a dress cinched tight at the waist, whose skirt flared out stiffly, ending halfway down her calves. The top of her dress had a low neckline that showed off her breasts. The man wore a dark suit like Erno's. They were completely differentiated by their dress, as if they were from different cultures, even species. Erno wondered where Rosamund had gotten the image. As Erno watched, the man nudged the woman to the side of the path, beneath one of the trees. He slid his hands around her waist and pressed his body against hers. She yielded softly to his embrace. Erno could not see their faces in the shadows, but they were inches apart. He felt his dick getting hard in his hand. He stepped back from the urinal, turned it off, and closed his pants. As the hum of the recycler died, the restroom swung open and a woman came in. She glanced at Erno and headed for one of the toilets. Erno went over to the counter and stuck his hands into the cleaner. The woman's presence sparked his anger. Without turning to face her but watching in the mirror, he said, "Why are you here tonight?" The woman looked up. She had been studying her fingernails, and her eyes locked on his. She was younger than his mother and had a pretty heart-shaped face. "I was curious. People are talking about him." "Do you think men want you here?"
"I don't know what the men want."
"Yes, that's the point, isn't it? Are you learning anything?"
"Perhaps."
The woman looked back at her hands. "Aren't you Pamela Meg's daughter's son?"
"So she tells me."
Erno pulled his tingling hands out of the cleaner. The woman used the bidet and dried herself. She had a great ass.
"Did she bring you, or did you bring her?" she asked.
"We brought ourselves," Erno said. He left the restroom. He looked out into the club again, listening to the noise. The crowd was rowdier and more raucous. The men's shouts of encouragement were like barks, their laughter edged with anger. His mother was still there. He did not want to see her or to have her see him. He went back past the restroom to the end of the hallway. The hall made a right angle into a dead end, but when Erno stepped into the bend, he saw, behind a stack of plastic crates, an old door. He wedged the crates to one side and opened the door enough to slip through. The door opened into a dark, dimly lit space. His steps echoed. As his eyes adjusted to the dim lights, he saw it was a very large room hewn out of the rock, empty except for some racks that must have held liquid oxygen cylinders back in the early days of the colony, when this place had been an actual oxygen warehouse. The light came from ancient bioluminescent units on the walls. The club must have been set up in this space years before. The tincture still lent Erno an edge of aggression, and he called out, "I'm Erno, King of the Moon! Ooh, ooh, oon!" The echoes came back, fading to stillness. He kicked an empty cylinder, which rolled forlornly a few meters before it stopped. He wandered around the chill vastness. At the far wall, one of the darker shadows turned out to be an alcove in the stone. Set in the back, barely visible in the dim light, was an ancient pressure door. Erno decided not to mess with it. It could open onto vacuum. He went back to the club door and slid into the hallway. Around the corner, two men were just coming out of the restroom, and Erno followed them as if he were just returning as well. The club was more crowded than ever. Every open space was filled with standing men, and others sat cross-legged up front. His mother and another constable had moved to the edge of the stage. "The problem with getting laid all the time is you can't think," Tyler was saying. "I mean, there's only so much blood in the human body. That's why those old Catholics back on Earth put the lock on the Pope's dick. He had an empire to run. The more time he spent taking care of John Thomas, the less he spent thinking up ways of getting money out of peasants. The secret of our moms is that if they keep that blood flowing below the belt, it ain't never gonna flow back above the shirt collar. Keeps the frequency of radical male ideas down." Tyler leaned over toward the drunk in the first row. "You know what I'm talking about, soldier?"
"You bet,"
the man said. He tried to stand, wobbled, sat down, tried to stand again.
"Where do you work?"
"Lunox."
The man found his balance.
"You're right, you—"
Tyler patted him on the shoulder.
"An oxygen boy. You know what I mean? You're out there on the processing line, and you're thinking about how maybe if you were to add a little more graphite to the reduction chamber, you could increase efficiency by 15%. And just then, Mary Ellen's swivel hips walks by in her skin tight, and bam!"
Tyler made the face of a man who'd been poleaxed.
What was I thinking of?"
The audience howled. 40 IQ points down the oubliette. And nothing's going to change until we get a handle on this. Am I right, brothers?" More howls, spiked with anger. Tyler was sweating, laughing, trembling, as if charged with electricity. "Keep your son close. Penis no, phallus see." Cheers now. Men stood and raised their fists. The drunk saw Erno's mother at the edge of the stage and took a step toward her. He said something, and while she and her partner stood irresolute, he put his big hand on her chest and shoved her away. The other constable discharged his electric club against the man. The drunk's arms flew back, striking a bystander, and two other men surged forward and knocked down the constable. Erno's mother raised her own baton. More constables pushed toward the stage, using their batons, and other men rose to stop them. A table was upended. Shouts echoed, the room was hot as hell, and turning into a riot, the first riot in the Society of Cousins in 50 years. As the crowd surged toward the exits or toward the constables, Erno ducked back to the hallway. He hesitated, and then Tyler Durden came stumbling out of the melee. He took a quick look at Erno. "What now, kid?" "Come with me," Erno said. He grabbed Tyler's arm and pulled him around the bend in the end of the hall, past the crates to the warehouse door. He slammed the door behind them and propped an empty oxygen cylinder against it. "We can hide here until the thing dies down."
"Who are you?"
"My name is Erno." "Well, Erno, are we sure we want to hide? Out there is more interesting." Erno decided not to tell Tyler that one of the constables was his mother. "Are you serious?"
"I'm always serious."
Durden wandered back from the door into the gloom of the cavern. He kicked a piece of rubble which soared across the room and skidded up against the wall 30 meters away. "This place must have been here since the beginning. I'm surprised they're wasting the space, probably full of toxics."
"You think so?"
Erno said.
"Who knows?"
Durden went toward the back of the warehouse, and Erno followed. It was cold, and their breath steamed the air. "Who would have figured the lights would still be growing?" Durden said. "A well-established colony can last for 50 years or more," Erno said. "As long as there's enough moisture in the air, they break down the rock."
"You know all about it."
"I work in biotech," Erno said. "I'm a gene hacker." Durden said nothing, and Erno felt the awkwardness of his boast. They reached the far wall. Durden found the pressure door set into the dark alcove. He pulled a flashlight from his belt. The triangular yellow warning signs around the door were faded. He felt around the door seam. "We probably ought to leave that alone," Erno said. Durden handed Erno the flashlight, took a pry bar from his belt, and shoved it into the edge of the door. The door resisted, then, with a grating squeak, jerked open a couple of centimeters. Erno jumped at the sound.
"Help me out here, Erno," Durden said.
Erno got his fingers around the door's edge, and the two of them braced themselves. Durden put his feet up on the wall and used his legs and back to get leverage. When the door suddenly shot open, Erno fell back and whacked his head. Durden lost his grip, shot sideways out of the alcove, bounced once, and skidded across the dusty floor. While Erno shook his head to clear his vision, Durden sat spread-legged, laughing.
"Bingo," he said. He bounced up. "You okay, Erno?"
Erno felt the back of his skull. He wasn't bleeding.
"I'm fine," he said. "Let's see what we've got, then."
Beyond the door, a dark corridor cut through the basalt. Durden stepped into the path marked by his light. Erno wanted to go back to the club. By now, things must have died down, but instead he followed. Shortly past the door, the corridor turned into a cramped lava tube. Early settlers had leveled the floor of the erratic tube formed by the draining away of cooling lava several billion years ago. Between walls that had been erected to form rooms ran a path of red volcanic gravel, much like tailings from the oxygen factory. Foamy, irregular pebbles kicked up by their shoes rattled off the walls. Dead light fixtures broke the ceiling at intervals. Tyler stopped to shine his light into a couple of the doorways, and at the third he went inside. "This must be from the start of the colony," Erno said. "I wonder why it's been abandoned."
"Kind of claustrophobic."
Durden shone the light around the small room. The light fell on a small rectangular object in the corner. From his belt, Durden pulled another tool which he extended into a probe.
Do you always carry this equipment? Erno asked.
Be prepared, Durden said.
He set down the light and crouched over the object. It looked like a small box, a few centimeters thick. You ever hear of the Boy Scouts, Erno?
Some early lunar colony?
Nope. Sort of like the men's house, only different. Durden forced the probe under an edge, and one side lifted as if to come off.
Well, well.
He put down the probe, picked up the object. He held it end on, put his thumbs against the long side, and opened it. It divided neatly into flat sheets, attached at the other long side.
What is it? Erno asked.
It's a book.
Is it still working?
This is an unpowered book. The words are printed right on these leaves. They're made of paper.
Erno had seen such old-fashioned books in vids.
It must be very old.
What is it?
Durden carefully turned the pages.
It's a book of stories.
Durden stood up and handed the book to Erno.
Here, you keep it. Let me know what it's about.
Erno tried to make out the writing, but without Tyler's flashlight, it was too dim. Durden folded up his probe and hung it on his belt. He ran his hand over his head, smearing a line of dust over his scalp.
Are you cold? I suppose we ought to find our way out of here.
Immediately, he headed out of the room and back down the corridor. Erno felt he was getting left behind in more ways than one. Clutching the book, he followed after Durden and his bobbing light. Rather than heading back to the oxygen warehouse, the comedian continued down the lava tube. Eventually, the tube ended in another old pressure door. When Durden touched the key panel at its side, amazingly, it lit.
What do you think? Durden said.
We should go back, Erno said. We can't know whether the locked door on the other side is still airtight. The failsafes could be broken. We could open the door onto vacuum. He held the book under his armpit and blew on his cold hands.
How old are you, Erno?
17.
17.
Durden's eyes glinted in shadowed eye sockets. 17 is no age to be cautious. Erno couldn't help but grin.
You're right. Let's open it.
My man, Erno. Durden slapped him on the shoulder. He keyed the open door. They heard the whine of a long unused electric motor. Erno could feel his heart beat, the blood running swiftly in his veins. At first, nothing happened. Then the door began to slide open. There was a chuff of air escaping from the lava tube, and dust kicked up. But the wind stopped as soon as it started, and the door opened completely on the old airlock, filled floor to ceiling with crates and bundles of fiberglass building struts. It took them half an hour to shift boxes and burrow their way through the airlock, to emerge at the other end into another warehouse, this one still in use. They crept by racks of construction materials until they reached the entrance and sneaked out into the colony corridor beyond. They were at the far end of North 6, the giant lava tube that served the industrial wing of the colony. The few workers they encountered on the late shift might have noticed Erno's suit, but said nothing. Erno and Tyler made their way back home. Tyler cracked jokes about the constables until they emerged into the vast open space of the domed crater that formed the center of the colony. Above, on the huge dome, was projected a night starfield. In the distance, down the rimwall slopes covered with junipers, across the crater floor, lights glinted among the trees in Sobieski Park. Erno took a deep breath, fragrant with pinyon.
The world our ancestors gave us, Tyler said, waving his arm as if offering it to Erno.
As Tyler turned to leave, Erno called out impulsively,
That was an adventure.
The first of many, Erno, Tyler said, and jogged away. Celibacy Day. On Celibacy Day, everyone gets a day off from sex. Some protest this practice, but they are relatively few. Most men take it as an opportunity to retreat to the informal men's houses that, though they have no statutory sanction, sprang up in the first generation of settlers. In the men's house, men and boys talk about what it is to be a man, a lover of other men and women, a father in a world where fatherhood is no more than a biological concept. They complain about their lot. They tell vile jokes and sing songs. They wrestle, they gossip. Heteros and queers and everyone in between compare speculations on what they think women really want, and whether it matters. They try to figure out what a true man is. As a boy, Erno would go to the men's house with his mother's current partner, or one of the other men involved in the household. Some of the men taught him things. He learned about masturbation and cross-checks and micro-language theory. But no matter how welcoming the men were supposed to be to each other, and they talked about brotherhood all the time, there was always that little edge when you met another boy there, or that necessary wariness when you talked to an adult. Men came to the men's house to spend time together and remind themselves of certain congruencies, but only a crazy person would want to live solely in the company of men. 2. The founders of the Society of Cousins had a vision of women as independent agents, free thinkers forming alliances with other women to create a social bond so strong that men could not overwhelm them. Solidarity, sisterhood, motherhood. But Erno's mother was not like those women. Those women existed only in history vids, sitting in meeting circles, laughing, making plans, sure of themselves, and complete. Erno's mother was a cop. She had a cop's squinty eyes and a cop's suspicion of anyone who stepped outside of the norm. She had a cop's lack of imagination, except as she could imagine what people would do wrong. Erno and his mother and his sister Celeste and his aunt Sophie and his cousins Lena and Afra, and various men, some of whom may have been fathers, some of them good partners, and others just men, lived in an apartment in Sanger, on the third level of the northeast quadrant, a small place looking down on the farms that filled the floor of the crater they called Fowler, though the real Fowler was a much larger crater 5 kilometers distant. Erno had his own room. He thought nothing of the fact that the girls had to share a room and would be forced to move out when they turned 14. "Keep your son close, let your daughter go," went the aphorism Tyler had mocked. Erno's mother was not about to challenge any aphorisms. Erno remembered her expression as she had stepped forward to arrest the drunk. Sad that this man had forced her to do this, and determined to do it. She was comfortable in the world. She saw no need for alternatives. Her cronies came by the apartment and shared coffee and gossip, and they were just like all the other mothers and sisters and aunts. None of them were extraordinary. Not that any of the men Erno knew were extraordinary either. Except Tyler Durden. And now Erno knew Durden, and they had spent a night breaking rules and getting away with it. Celeste and Afra were dishing up oatmeal when Erno returned to the apartment that morning. "Where were you?" his mother asked. She looked up from the table, more curious than upset. And Erno noticed a bruise on her temple. "What happened to your forehead?" Erno asked. Her mother touched a hand to her forehead, as if she had forgotten it. She waved the hand in dismissal. "There was trouble at a club in the Enterprise District," Aunt Sophie said. "The constables had to step in, and your mother was assaulted." "It was a riot," Lena said eagerly. "There's going to be a big meeting about it in the park today." Lena was a month from turning 14 and looking forward to voting. Erno sat down at the table. As he did so, he felt the book, which he had tucked into his belt at the small of his back, beneath his now rumpled suit jacket. He leaned forward, pulled a bowl of oatmeal toward him, and took up a spoon. Looking down into the bowl to avoid anyone's eyes, he idly asked, "What's the meeting for?" "One of the rioters was knocked into a coma," Lena said. "The Social Order Committee wants this comedian Tyler Durden to be made invisible." Erno concentrated on his spoon. "Why?" "You know about him?" his mother asked. Before he had to think of an answer, Nick Farrison, his mother's partner, shambled into the kitchen.
Lord, Pam, don't you pay attention? Erno's one of his biggest fans.
His mother turned on Erno.
Is that so?
Erno looked up from his bowl and met her eyes. She looked hurt.
I've heard of him.
Heard of him? Nick said.
Erno, I bet you were there last night.
I bet you weren't there, Erno said.
Nick stretched.
I don't need to hear him. I have no complaints.
He came up behind Erno's mother, nuzzled the nape of her neck, and cupped her breast in his hand.
She turned her face up and kissed him on the cheek.
I should hope not.
Lena made a face.
Heteros. I can't wait until I get out of here.
She had recently declared herself a lesbian and was quite judgmental about it.
You'd better get to your practicum, Lena, Aunt Sophie said. Let your aunt take care of her own sex life.
This guy Durden is setting himself up for a major fall, said Nick.
Smells like a case of abnormal development. Who's his mother?
Erno couldn't keep quiet.
He doesn't have a mother. He doesn't need one.
Parthenogenesis, Aunt Sophie said. I didn't think it had been perfected yet.
If they ever do, what happens to me? Nick said.
You have your uses. Erno's mother nudged her shoulder against his hip.
You two can go back to your room, Aunt Sophie said. We'll take care of things for you.
No need. Nick grabbed a bowl of oatmeal and sat down.
Thank you, sweetheart, he said to Aphra. I can't see what this guy's problem is.
Doesn't it bother you that you can't vote? Erno said. What's fair about that?
I don't want to vote, Nick said.
You're a complete drone. His mother frowned at him. Erno pushed his bowl away and left for his room.
You're the one with special tutoring, Lena called. The nice clothes, what work do you do?
Shut up, Erno said softly, but his ears burned. He had nothing to do until his 1100 biotech tutorial, and he didn't even have to go if he didn't want to. Lena was right about that anyway. He threw the book on his bed, undressed, and switched on his screen. On the front page was a report of solar activity approaching its 11-year peak, with radiation warnings issued for all surface activity. Erno called up the calendar. There it was. A discussion on Tyler Durden was scheduled in the amphitheater at 1600. Linked was a vid of the riot and a forum for open citizen comment. A cousin named Tashi Yokio-san had been clubbed in the fight and was in a coma, undergoing nano repair. Erno didn't know him, but that didn't prevent his anger. He considered calling up Tyrus or Sid, finding out what had happened to them, and telling them about his adventure with Tyler. But that would spoil the secret, and it might get around to his mother. Yet he couldn't let his night with Tyler go uncelebrated. He opened his journal and wrote a poem. Going outside the crater, finding the lost tunnels of freedom and male strength, searching with your brother, shoulder to shoulder, like men. Getting below the surface of a stifling society, sounding your XY shout, flashing your colors like an ancient Spartan bird, proud, erect, never to be softened by the silent embrace of woman. No females allowed. Not bad. It had some of the raw honesty of the beats. He would read it at the next meeting of the Poets Club. He saved it with the 400 other poems he had written in the last year. Erno prided himself on being the most prolific poet in his class. He had already won 4 Laurel Awards, 1 for Best Lyric, 1 for Best Sonnet, and 2 for Best Villanelle, plus a Snappy for Best Limerick of 2097. He was sure to make Bard at an earlier age than anyone since Patrick Morrison. Erno switched off the screen, lay on his bed, and remembered the book. He dug it out from under his discarded clothes. It had a blue cover faded to purple near the binding,
made of some sort of fabric. Embossed on the front was a torch encircled by a laurel wreath. He opened the book to its title page, Stories for Men, an anthology by Charles Grayson, published in August 1936 in the United States of America. As a fan of Earth culture, Erno knew that most Earth societies use the patronymic, so that Gray, Grayson's naming parent, would be a man, not a woman. Stories for Men. The authors on the contents page were all men, except perhaps for odd names like Dashiell. Despite Erno's interest in 20th century popular art, only a couple were familiar. William Faulkner he knew was considered a major Earth writer, and he had seen the name Hemingway before, though he had associated it only with a style of furniture. But even assuming the stories were all written by men, the title said the book was stories for men, not stories by men. How did a story for a man differ from a story for a woman? Erno had never considered the idea before. He had heard storytellers in the park and read books in school. Murasaki, Chopin, Cather, Ellison, Morrison, Ference, Sabin's Daughter. As a child, he had loved the Alice books and Flatland and Maria Hidalgo's kid stories and Seuss. None seemed particularly male or female. He supposed the cousins did have their own stories for men. Nick loved interactive serials, tortured romantic tales of interpersonal angst set in the patriarchal world, where men struggled against injustice until they found the right women and were taken care of. Erno stuck to poetry. His favorite novel was Tawanda Tamika's Daughter's The Dark Blood, the story of a misunderstood young cousin's struggles against his overbearing mother, climaxed when his father miraculously reveals himself and brings the mother to heel. At the men's house, he had also seen his share of porn, thrillers set on Earth where men forced women to do whatever the men wanted, and like it. But this book did not look like porn. A note at the beginning promised the book contained material to interest or alarm or amuse or instruct or, and possibly most important of all, entertain you. Erno wondered that Tyler had found this particular 160-year-old book in the lava tube. It seemed too unlikely to be coincidence. What sort of things would entertain an Earthman of 1936? Erno turned to the first story, The Ambassador of Poker by Ahmed Abdullah. But the archaic text was frustratingly passive. Nothing more than black type physically impressed on the pages without links or explanations. After a paragraph or so, rife with obscure cultural references, Cordovan brogues, Knickerbockers, County Sligo, a four in hand, Erno's night without sleep caught up with him, and he dozed off. Heroes. Why does a man remain in the society of cousins when he would have much more authority outside of it, in one of the other lunar colonies or on Earth? For one thing, the sex is great. Men are valued for their sexuality, praised for their potency, competed for by women. From before puberty, a boy is schooled by both men and women on how to give pleasure. A man who can give such pleasure has high status. He is recognized and respected throughout the colony. He is welcome in any bed. He is admired and envied by other men. 3. Erno woke suddenly, sweaty and disoriented, trailing the wisps of a dream that faded before he could call it back. He looked at his clock, 15:30. He was going to miss the meeting. He washed his face, applied personal hygiene bacteria, threw on his embroidered jumpsuit, and rushed out of the apartment. The amphitheater in Sobieski Park was filling as Erno arrived. 500 or 600 people were already there. Other cousins would be watching on the link. The dome presented a clear blue sky, and the ring of heliotropes around its zenith flooded the air with sunlight. A slight breeze rustled the old oaks, hovering over the semicircular ranks of seats like aged grandmothers. People came in twos and threes, adults and children, along the paths that led down from the colony perimeter road through the farmlands to the park. Others emerged from the doors at the base of the central spire that supported the dome. Erno found a seat in the top row, far from the stage, off to one side where the seats gave way to grass. Chairing the meeting was Deborah's daughter. Deborah's daughter was a tiny 60-year-old woman who, though she had held public office infrequently and never for long, was one of the most respected cousins. She had been Erno's teacher when he was six, and he remembered how she'd sat with him and worked through his feud with Bill Gredesen. She taught him how to play forward on the soccer team. On the soccer field, she had been fast and sudden as a bug. She had a warm laugh and sharp brown eyes. Down on the stage, Deborah's daughter was hugging the secretary. Then the sound person hugged Deborah's daughter. They both hugged the secretary again. A troubled-looking old man sat down in the front row, and all three of them got down off the platform and hugged him. He brushed his hand along Deborah's daughter's thigh, but it was plain that his heart wasn't in it. She kissed his cheek and went back up on the stage. A flyer wearing red wings swooped over the amphitheater and soared back up again, slowly beating the air. Another pair of flyers were racing around the perimeter of the crater, silhouetted against the clusters of apartments built into the crater walls. 1,000 meters above his head, Erno could spy a couple of others on the edge of the launch platform at the top of the spire. As he watched, squinting against the sunlight, one of the tiny figures spread its wings and pushed off, diving down at first ever so gently, gaining speed, then with a flip of wings soaring out level. Erno could feel it in his own shoulders, the stress that maneuver put on your arms. He didn't like flying. Even in lunar gravity, the chances of a fall were too big. The amplified voice of Deborah's daughter drew him back to the amphitheater. "Thank you, cousins, for coming," she said. "Please come to order." Erno saw that Tyler Durden had taken a seat off to one side of the stage. He wore flaming red coveralls, like a shout. "A motion has been made to impose a decree of invisibility against Thomas Merryson, otherwise known as Tyler Durden, for a period of 1 year. We are met here for the first of two discussions over this matter prior to holding a colony-wide vote." Short of banishment, invisibility was the colony's maximum social sanction. Should the motion carry, Tyler would be formally ostracized. Tagged by an AI, continuously monitored, he would not be acknowledged by other cousins. Should he attempt to harm anyone, the AI would trigger receptors in his brainstem to put him to sleep. This motion was prompted by the disturbances that have ensued as a result of public performances of Thomas Merryson. The floor is now open for discussion. A very tall woman who had been waiting anxiously stood, and, as if by prearrangement, Deborah's daughter recognized her. The hovering mics picked up her high voice. "I am Yokio Kumio's daughter. My son is in the hospital as a result of this shameful episode. He is a good boy. He is the kind of boy we all want, and I don't understand how he came to be in that place. I pray that he recovers and lives to be the good man I know he can be. We must not let this happen to anyone else's son. At the very least, invisibility will give Thomas Merryson the opportunity to reflect on his actions before he provokes another such tragedy."